Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer. Now, there's no Gregor Robertson today, but fear not, we have some more than able replacements in the form of Alison Rudd, Tom Clark and Jonathan Northcroft. Coming up, we're talking West Ham, midweek travel woes, and we're going to quiz our expert panel on Premier League goalkeepers. But first, we're looking at the state of England's defenders. All that to come after this.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So let's start with John Stones and what has gone wrong for him at Manchester City. The Times reported this week that Pep Guardiola wants two new central defenders this summer, with Stones set to be pushed out the door. Alison, what do you think has happened to John Stones?
Wouldn't we all like to know the real reason he's not quite fulfilled his early promise? First of all, he was at fault for the two goals conceded against Crystal Palace. And when that was highlighted by the press a few weeks ago, Pep said, that's wrong to criticise him. It's not his fault. But the way Pep phrased his defence of Stones was, he has it all. He has the ability. So in a way, he encapsulated. He was saying, you know, you can't have a go at one player for a couple of mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. John Stones has great ability. That in itself tells you everything that Pep thinks about John Stones, which is Pep was not wrong to spend nearly 50 million quid on him. He identified a player that does have some innate great centre-back ability. And if you're part of a Man City team, that involves being very good with the ball at your feet and being an intelligent passer and distributor of the ball and making snap decisions that are intelligent, not of the hoof variety. But he's sort of saying, I know it's there inside, but I've done my best, the club's done their best. It's down to him to find a way to translate that into the calibre of defender we expect at this club. So don't have a go at him for making a mistake that anyone could make, even someone at the peak of their aura and form would make. But at the same time, you sort of do feel it's the end of the road, perhaps, for Stones at City, because what they thought they were buying just hasn't emerged. And I think it's partly a huge risk when you take someone on who's young, because he looks the part. He's athletic and he's tall and he looks like someone who could be commanding. But that just doesn't come from being athletic and tall. You have to have the personality to be commanding. I don't think, for example, what Virgil van Dijk possesses is teachable. So Virgil looks the part, but he just has this. He does actually have a way of commanding space. And it's got to the point now where opposition teams, when they're playing Liverpool, they don't talk so much about the pace of Mo Salah. They talk about, let's not let Virgil clear the ball. I mean, imagine that you've got to the point where you're worrying about what you'll do at a corner where you're attacking, which defender's going to head it out. Do not let it be Virgil van Dijk, because not only will he get there before anyone that you own will get there, he'll do something very clever with it. So that I don't think you can teach that. That's something you have or you don't have, because you just take over the agenda. And Stones, I just think possibly he was a year too young, or too much was written about him and said about him, and he's found it difficult to reach that level that people thought he should be at.
Jonathan, if Pep is picking Nicolas Otamendi, which he seems to be doing right now, over Stones, that in itself is pretty damning.
Yeah, that's apart from maybe sticking David Luiz or somebody in front of you, it's about as bigger comment as it gets. I mean, you know, he's effectively been playing a midfielder and Otamendi at times this season instead of Stones. I listened with interest to what Ali was saying and agreed with a lot of it, that we're talking about, especially when it comes to defending, a position where you're required to do more than just, you know, instinctively use ability. It's about decision-making. Much of football, much of top-level sports about decision-making, but particularly playing in central defence in the Premier League, it's about personality and it's about steadiness and calm. And those are the things that John Stones hasn't developed as he's moved into his 20s. And, you know, Laporte is the same age, similar age, and might even be younger, but it's got all those things. It's got those commanding attributes. Van Dijk, of course, does. Van Dijk's got the ability to improve the people around him. Nobody seems to be better when they're playing with John Stones. I was at both of the games where he's had chances recently and disappointed. The Palace game, he looked fairly broken at the end when Palace got their equaliser. I was at the Manchester United game where, again, he wasn't the only problem, but, you know, he was a man supposed to be holding it together and didn't. And I don't think this is a new phenomenon. I guess the point I would make about this is that the decline of John Stones and Pep Guardiola's loss of faith in Stones has been happening for a long time. This is a player that since the 2018 World Cup has started less than half of City's games, and he's only been injured for about four of those. I'm talking in the Premier League. You know, he's not even been in the squad for, I think, five of the last seven games or something like that. He is in crisis in terms of his Manchester City career. And he also looks like someone that's just lost his way a little bit. He's had, I think, off-field issues that have been documented in some of the tabloids. I don't know. I don't have any idea if they've played a part in his form on the pitch. But he certainly looks on the pitch like someone that's just lost their way a little bit. And I wrote a piece a few months ago saying that Stones is potentially the most important footballer in the country this year, because him getting back to form would or wouldn't help Manchester City stave off Liverpool. This was and his importance to England is massive. And what I sort of said in that piece is, you know, which John Stones stands up is going to answer a lot of the questions. And I think we've seen what's happened to Manchester City, and I'd be worried from an England point of view if he can't regain some of his old authority. Because in 2018, he was fantastic. That player of authority and decision-making that we know that he can be, we saw that in the World Cup. He was absolutely outstanding. And it's just odd how much he's fallen since that sort of high point.
Johnny, it sounds absolutely lovely in your garden, by the way.
I thought it was at City Training, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Keeping tabs. Oh, no, no birds like that in Manchester, I can tell you.
Indeed.
I do wonder with the Pep point, though. Alison, you've talked about Virgil van Dijk. If you look at another England defender, Harry Maguire, I agree to an extent that you can't teach some of the things that you're talking about, but Stones played fewer than 100 games for Barnsley and Everton before he joined Manchester City. If you look at the likes of Maguire and Van Dijk, play for Celtic, Southampton in the Premier League, at a higher level probably than Stones, and more often. Harry Maguire, I think, played, you know, over 200 games for Hull, Wigan, Sheffield United, Leicester. Some of the things that you're talking about, that ability to dominate, isn't that what you learn as you're playing and as you're learning the trade of being a centre-half? And isn't that something that your manager should be helping you with? I do think, I agree with your point that Pep has cleverly said, you know, he's got everything. But in a way, that's almost Mourinho-esque in that, you know, oh, well, you know, I can't do everything. I mean, you're meant to be Pep Guardiola. Like, should he not have been doing more with John?
But he's not going to do that at City. And in a way, you've answered your own question, because
but should he not have been doing it in the last few years?
Harry Maguire is allowed to do it out of the spotlight at a club which will absorb his mistakes.
But when you sign a player much younger than that, do you not take on that responsibility that he would have had if he'd stayed at Everton, say, and played under some different managers, or maybe moved up and then had moved to City? Does Pep not assume that responsibility of...
That's not Pep's style of management, though, is it? Pep clearly thought for that amount of money it was already there, and that Stones would be able to fairly quickly slot into a system, and he didn't. But at Manchester City, you do not learn through hard knocks. You either slot in or you don't.
There's definitely a point about, yeah, I agree on that, but there's also a factor here where, you know, one minute he was playing alongside Kompany and he was the kind of the passing man. And then, you know, nowadays, as Johnny, you've mentioned him, Laporte, who is a much better passer. Mm. I mean, I would argue a good enough passer that he could be a number 10 sometimes. Mm. So Stones then kind of assumes that I'm the Van Dijk figure, I'm the hard man, the dominant one. And he's never been able to learn either properly because he's played one role or another depending on who he's alongside. I feel massively sorry for him, and I think England are going to suffer massively because of what's happened with him. And I also think because he was bought so young, he became a bit of a kind of symbol for the defender who makes the cock-up when he's trying to play the ball out for the back. And lots of defenders make mistakes all the time, but John Stones gets referenced more than any
you
other.
You cannot tell a player nor teach a player have an aura. You can't do that. You either develop it because you've got it or you haven't.
I agree, but I'm saying that his development of that aura has been hindered by Pep Guardiola and how he's been used. So I'm saying I agree with you that you develop it yourself. I'm not saying Pep gives it him. But I'm saying Pep has hindered his ability to develop that aura.
I think that aura, and I think some of the things we're talking about comes from personality traits, actually. And I think there's one that you can teach, which is concentration. And I'm not sure his concentration's ever been good enough. Carragher always used to talk about how Stones didn't have that ability to smell danger, you know, that phrase they use. That's a concentration thing. And in terms of the aura, I think that comes from calmness. I think that comes from being sort of, you know, at peace, and that's what Van Dijk's got as a person. Now, Stones, despite being this sort of, you know, composed on the ball kind of guy, has never quite had that. And I actually do wonder if that's just a personality trait that you can't teach, that is lacking. So I think there's two things. I think there's one thing that he could concentrate better, but he could also be a bit more calmer and authoritative as a person. And that second thing might just be something he'll never have.
How are your herbaceous borders, Jonathan, by the way? And shall we turn this into gardener's question time? Because I feel it would just be fantastic if you were to start talking about rhododendrons.
Yeah, it's John Stones with a chainsaw behind you. He's hearing everything you're saying.
I'm sorry, yes. That's not me sort of taking a chainsaw to all the pretty flowers in my garden, by the way. That's my neighbour.
That's good to hear.
It does sound as though, Alison, for example, with yourself, that you're thinking his time at City is coming to an end. But in terms of where next for John Stones, he's only, 25, 26 at the end of May. There's still time for him to mature as a defender. Do you still see him possibly as an elite defender?
Well, I think we're entering catch 22 territory for John Stones, because say he goes to Arsenal and is reunited with Mikel Arteta, who by all accounts they got on well, and Arsenal have need of calibre defending, he would still be going, whilst you could argue that I'd be like going into a family environment that wouldn't be entirely alien to him, he'd still be going as the saviour of Arsenal's defence. And there would be a lot of expectation on him. And the way he is behaving at the moment, and as Jonathan pointed out, the lack of concentration, that comes from nerves, I think, and trying too hard often, because you're trying to think about too many things instead of just relaxing into your role. You feel you've got a point to prove. And once you start feeling nervous or thinking about what you're going to do, and it's not automatic because you're in the zone, it goes wrong for you. So I think if you went with a burden of expectation to a big club such as Arsenal, I don't actually think that would help him. I think that would just be another spotlight of a slightly different colour, but it would still be a spotlight. And perhaps because, as Tom very eloquently pointed out, the defenders who are above him in the pecking order for England, or are just considered good defenders in the Premier League, have spent longer at clubs where they weren't, you know, that much in the public eye, and they were able to learn their craft without too many people commentating on every single, you know, foot put where, header put where. Unless he goes abroad, I would say, yeah, go abroad. Go abroad somewhere where they don't really care that you're seen as a great English hope that's died. They just see a decent defender. Go abroad and just sort of start again.
Another turbulent week on and off the pitch for West Ham United. After throwing away a two-goal lead to draw at home to Brighton, they have banned a supporter who wore an anti-board T-shirt while acting as a flag bearer at the London Stadium. The season ticket holder Cameron Robson received a letter on Tuesday detailing how they believe he intended to incite the crowd ahead of their Premier League defeat by Liverpool. Robson had volunteered to wave a giant flag while the players walked out. And on the T-shirt that he was wearing, it had GSB out, Gold Sullivan Brady out slogan, which could be seen after he unzipped his coat. That's resulted in his ban. Tom, do we think he deserved that ban?
No, but I mean, the point about the ban is that it shows, you know, once again, an ownership completely out of touch with its fans. I mean, the West Ham owners make Ed Woodward look like a, you know, a loyal genius to Manchester United supporters. I mean, you know, we've seen this time and time again. You know, we had fans on the pitch in 2018, you know, scrapping with Mark Noble. I mean, if you've got a West Ham fans prepared to do that, then they're very, very, very upset. And I mean, I argued with Gregor a couple of weeks ago that they would be safe, and he said that it's the off the field, you know, rows and supporter anger that will undo them in the end. I still think they'll be safe, but it is remarkable how angry the fans are. I mean, one of my best friends is a West Ham season ticket holder, and he and his dad, you know, they still go, which you could argue that's where it really falls down, because they're still paying their money and turning up. But I mean, they are so angry at how the club has been run. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if this guy's worn a T-shirt and is being banned, I mean, it tells you everything you need to know really about, you know, the ownership of the club, I think.
I mean, how important is it, Jonathan, for owners to have a relationship with fans? Or is it not important at all, actually?
Well, I mean, football always comes back to results. So I suppose it's possible to have no relationship at all as long as the team's doing well. Of course it is. But it certainly helps if there's a relationship. I think to yet again, I suppose, take it back to Liverpool, which we're going to do at the moment because they're doing so well. But that's an example of a club that has got a unity about it on and off the pitch, which that kind of virtuous circle that helps. That was certainly the case at Leicester, has been and probably still is. You can see it at Sheffield United, you know, albeit that their specific owners are fighting with each other and all that kind of stuff. But when there's an idea that the club is at one with the fans, is what I'm trying to get at, that creates an extra energy in the stadiums and an extra energy for the team. And the opposite's happening at West Ham. It's a product, you know, Tom talks about the anger, and I think it's an anger that's built over the years since the move. And the problem with that move was always going to be to wrench those supporters away from Upton Park involved selling them a dream. And the problem's always going to be if the dream didn't sort of come true, and it's far from coming true at the moment. They raised expectations by splurging under Pellegrini on, you know, quote unquote glamour players who have, you know, been like the bubbles. They've kind of been shiny and bright, and then they've burst. And you know, I'm thinking of Anderson and Yarmolenko and, you know, Lanzini, Haller. They haven't quite lived up to it. I think that's probably created some of the anger as well. And, you know, a few years on from the stadium move, they're now back to British players fighting relegation and far from that kind of top six dream. So I don't quite know how they get that back, to be honest, how they get that trust back without swallowing hard and probably spending more money. And the one thing I think it is unfair to level at them is the money thing. They spent about 120 million in the last two windows net. So they have put money in, they've just spent it badly. And that in itself is not going to save them. The fans, they probably need to spend more. And I'm not sure if they have the stomach for that.
It's interesting. I had an argument with a friend about the situation at West Ham, and he was saying, well, West Ham fans have this sense of entitlement for some reason. And I was arguing, well, the reason they have a sense of entitlement is, as you pointed out, Jonathan, the promises that they've been given, the assurances that they'd be playing Champions League football. But obviously, looking at the state of play right now, they're obviously nowhere near that.
Nowhere near it. And, you know, you always compare yourself to people, and you know, Spurs are suddenly in an even better stadium, miles better stadium, and it's coincided with great years for them. They'll be looking at, you know, Leicester and why can't they be anywhere near what they're doing? It feels like they've sort of slightly gone backwards, and they've on the pitch, and they've lost that great thing that they had, which was Upton Park, and the sort of, you know, there's a point where that sort of European dream is going to become almost laughable to think of. It's a messy, difficult situation, really difficult one, and the short term things sort of somehow trying to create enough unity or tolerance to fight off relegation, because if they go down, it's disastrous.
We know, of course, that they have been monitoring what media outlets have been saying, so let's be a little bit careful. But Alison, do we think some of the problems at West Ham stem from too much attention being placed on the things that happen off the pitch?
I think they're a club that have big personalities at the helm. I've been talking to a lot of fans this week in preparation for a piece for the paper, hopefully, if I manage to sneak it in past the lawyers. The significant thing I found, actually, because sort of every 18 months or so, I do a splurge on a club and see what the mood is. 18 months ago, it was all about how unhappy they were with the stadium. Lost our spiritual home. The walk from the tube, various tubes to the ground, is long and soulless, and it's half and half scarves and no pubs, and it's horrible, horrible, horrible. And you're miles from the action, and you just very hard to get an atmosphere going. Suddenly, it's as though it's not that they've accepted and are happy with the stadium, but that is not the focal point anymore. Mm-hmm. The focal point has shifted. The anger has shifted to the ownership, which is why you saw the T-shirt with that slogan on it. The disaffected fans are thinking, well, we've been lumbered with this stadium, which doesn't suit us and we don't like it. But why? Why has that happened? And who's behind it? And how, as you say, Natalie, how is it all affecting our team? And the fans would like, instead of having big personalities in charge of the club, they'd like a proper director of football, for example. They'd like people making decisions who know what football is about. Because... as Jonathan says, they're spending the money, but there's no pattern to it. There's no, you can't say, oh, West Ham have a certain style anymore. No single purchase makes any particular sense. And the players that the fans like are players who, through, like Mark Noble, because he so loves the club and has never ever stopped running. He's ancient now, but he runs more than anybody else still. So they love him. But you shouldn't really have to build a team around someone in approaching their mid 30s. And yet, logically, you probably should, because he's the only player the fans have any connection with. They need somebody who can impose again an identity, so that when you spend that amount of money, and it is a lot of money, that you buy players that fit into the system, so you slowly climb the table. And a lot of fans are sort of quite accepting that they'll probably go down.
They did try a director of football. I think he just didn't work. He just wasn't very
good. Well, a good one, I think.
No, exactly. You're right, Alison. They've spent the money. They've tried to do it. I just think they've backed the wrong horses. They probably backed the wrong guy in Pellegrini and the wrong director of football in Husilos. And this is what they're left with. And I'd just be curious. I know I wait to read it, but what the fans actually want out of the owners, because while I think that Sullivan and so on have been misguided, they've misjudged things, I think at heart they are people who have run football clubs successfully before. They've spent money, they've got a connection. I'm just not sure what owners, West Ham fans, want, but I do get that this is so far from the dream that, and the particularly the recruitment's been so bad that they want to blame someone. But I'm interested to know, do they want a sort of foreign owner to come in and splurge, or surely that would lose their identity even further.
Well, they're split. I mean, they're split on that. You won't, and that's part of the problem in a way. The fan disaffection mirrors the club, the way the club is run, because there are lots of different groups with different agendas and different levels of anger. The West Ham Independent Supporters Association, they they really don't like the fact that Karen Brady is so busy doing other things, and they think perhaps the club would be run better if there was a CEO who didn't have a high profile, didn't make TV shows, and just quietly worked behind the scenes. For example, other fans are just embarrassed by the way that a Golden Sullivan tweet. You know, they don't don't want owners that do that. You'll find different fans with different attitudes. If you ask them what they do want, they don't actually want a foreign owner unless they're, you know, got impeccable credentials. I mean, it could be a pipe dream in many ways that they would get someone better.
But while we are on the subject of it, and Tom, you've already alluded to the fact you still think they're going to stay up, and this is despite the fact that in their next two games they head to Manchester City and to Liverpool as well. Let's not forget they've also got games against the resurgent Southampton, Arsenal with Mikel Arteta. They've got Wolves, Tottenham, Chelsea. Goodness me, the list goes on, really. These are not easy end-of-season games coming up.
No, they're not. And I mean,
And yet you still back them.
I still back them, partly because I'm a stubborn man and I said it 2 weeks ago, so I'm going to stick with it until they're definitely relegated. And Gregor won't let me forget it. I mean, I still think they've got players there in Mark Noble who can, you know, corral the rest of the squad into some big performances in those difficult games. And I mean, in my history of following football, this is what West Ham do in those games. They pluck a 1-0 win out of thin air and start a little bit of a run, because they then do finish the season with Newcastle, Burnley, Norwich, Watford, Manchester United and Villa. So if they pick up some points and can get a little bit of unity back, even if it's just within the squad, if it's not within the fan groups and the ownership, then they will have enough just to stay up. And then they start that awful process of the summer comes and the big dreams come back and everyone starts thinking what will next season hold, and the cycle starts again. But I think they will stay up. Just
Jonathan, can you be as confident?
No, I'd mirror Tom, actually, that I think they'll sort of do it. I think they'll have to win one of those big games. Usually your teams that stay up do kick the start themselves by pulling off the unexpected result, and I think Saturday was a really sore one. And the frustration for West Ham, I suppose, is that but for a VAR decision, they probably wouldn't have had this week's media coverage. You know, that's how thin the margins were. They'd have beaten Brighton and things would be okay. But they didn't. That's left them. I think they have to win one of those big games. And they should have enough with David Moyes' experience, ability to organise, and some of the players that they've got. You still feel they should have enough. The worry for them, I suppose, is goals. But that's probably the worry for every relegation-threatened team.
Alison, can we complete the hat-trick? Are you backing them to stay up?
Not really, no. I don't see how you can when Mark Noble, 33, was he nearly 33, is the player who covers most ground. You can't. I mean, I've seen every single other team play better than West Ham. I mean, Norwich, most people say they're almost cut adrift. I've seen them play brilliantly, often.
Mm, yeah.
With pace.
Yeah. Good side.
So I don't see enough in the qualities you need to just get by in the Premier League. West Ham don't have them on the pitch. No matter how good an organisation Moyes is.
Yeah, but I just think they'll almost start their season now. They've had the turbulation and the mad signings, and they'll just start the season from scratch, and all these players will come out of the woodwork again. You know, your Snodgrasses and all those kind of people and the big superstars will be
but
on the bench.
But they've only got one Snodgrass. There aren't more than one. It's not very well saying Snodgrasses,
they've got one
if
Snodgrass
only.
And
he's
one
good.
Mark Noble.
He's good.
That's all right. That's
there was only one.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We've got to give a special mention here on the pod to Barrow AFC today. 23 brave souls made the 740-mile round trip from Cumbria to Dover Athletic on Tuesday night for their non-league clash. Now, it started off well. The Barrow manager, Ian Everett, bought the 23 of them sausage and bacon rolls for the journey, which began at 10 a.m. for a 7:45 kickoff. But then things went wrong. With the game at 1-1, Michael Woods got Dover's winner with just 2 minutes to go to break the travelling fans' hearts. After getting on board the bus home, the fans then had expected to make a quick getaway in the hope that they might get home by around about 5 a.m. Instead, they found out the players' coach had broken down, so the fans offered up space on theirs. The journey included a stop at the services, with the fans forced to wait on the coach whilst the players queued for some fast food, some chicken fast food variety. One fan, 18-year-old Taylor Nelson, didn't get home until 7 a.m. and with no sleep went to college for a politics lesson. My goodness, that sounds like a bit of a nightmare journey. Anyone experienced similar? Tom, following Lincoln?
Yeah, several. I mean, I only need to go back about a couple of months to a trip that started on a Friday night and ended with me and my dad leaving Sunderland, having seen us lose 3-1 and been 3-0 down in about 30 minutes, including when our centre-half decided to duck a header, only to watch the Sunderland striker waltz through and score. I mean, various nightmare away trips. I mean, I would just check that no one's from Mansfield and anyone's got any family from Mansfield. No. I'm not going to... I mean, OK.
I mean, you might offend some listeners, but
absolutely. I mean, that's... I'm getting a bit of a habit of that, I'm sure. I went to Mansfield on a Monday night to watch Lincoln, and let me tell you, it's not a place on a Monday night. And it included a walk back to my little hotel room on the outskirts of Mansfield. You had to walk through the centre of Mansfield, and it's a bit of a local rivalry, and it finished 1-1 thanks to Big John Akindi's penalty. What a legend. I walked out of the ground, and I deliberately packed a different coat, so I was wearing a very brightly coloured little mac over the top of my coat, took it off so as not to look, you know, if anyone had picked me out for a bit of a scrap afterwards, because there was fights kicking off all over the place. And I'm walking through the centre of Mansfield, and it's like a ghost town. The only thing you can see are police vans and, you know, a few sirens. Ducked into a chippy for some chips for the walk home. Walked out, and I heard, "Oi!" And I thought, oh, crap. I'm either going to have to sacrifice the chips or get into a fight. Turned around, and I'd just left my wallet on the counter.
Oh.
And it was just a chip shop owner. So,
sounds,
I mean,
nice.
Yeah, it
actually
was a nice end to a rather scary, scary 24
built
hours
it
in
up,
Mansfield.
And I'm thinking this is all going to end horribly, but it... Not so
well, bad. Yeah, it ended with chips and a, you know, restored faith in humanity, but won't be going to Mansfield anytime soon, that's for certain.
Right, Field Mill is ticked off. Don't need
ticked
to go
off,
there.
Ticked off, never again.
Alison, come on, you must have had some nightmare journeys.
I've got thousands.
Go on. Apart from,
can we have
I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we've all been on the M1 when it's closed, or the M62 or M whatever it is. But go on. What about your nightmare journeys?
Well, most involve, because I take my job so seriously.
Yes, well,
like,
done.
All
Alison.
I care about is getting to the ground. I don't often think about how I'm going to get back.
So it's
mainly my own fault, a lot of them. Although I've been on team buses and they said, just don't turn around, don't look at us, just eyes forward, because I couldn't
really
get there. Yeah. But anyway, the story I will tell is I was 8 months pregnant and I had to go to Ipswich from West London, and because it was the first child, had a, has anyone heard of a Nissan ZX? Very sporty car.
Sounds fancy.
It was one of those. And so I thought, well, I'll drive in my Nissan ZX to Ipswich, because there were no trains back. So I drove, but I mean, the traffic was abominable.
On the A14?
Roads I'd never heard of, never been on before, had no idea you couldn't just go on a motorway from. Yes. Anyway, so that was stressful enough. So I got to the near the ground quite late, really, for me. I was thinking, where am I going to put the car? Where am I going to put the car? And there was a garden gate, and it seemed quite cheap, a fiver or something. So I pulled in, gave some random bloke a fiver, parked the car, waddled to the, because I was 8 months pregnant, waddled to the stadium. I'd arrived in the light, got to the stadium, watched the game, did a rewrite, walked out the stadium. It's pitch black and very, very quiet. A bit like your Mansfield. I mean, some place, I mean, you, if you live in London, you forget how quiet it can get when you're not in London.
Scarily.
So it was
quiet.
It was quiet, and I hadn't a clue where I was. I hadn't made a little map. I hadn't thought, you know, turn left at the chippy or whatever. I just thought, where the hell have I put my car? And I'd remembered one, you know, point of marker. I think it was a big advertising hoarding. I was thinking maybe someone will know that advertising hoarding. There was nobody around, and except there was one police car going very slowly round a roundabout. So I stepped out in front of it and waved, and I was evidently a waddly pregnant woman. And the police just did a sort of dismissive, get on with it, love. Wouldn't stop, which made me very angry. So it took me quite a long time of just wandering the streets of Ipswich. Eventually found the garden where I'd parked my Nissan ZX. But the gate was locked. Big gate was locked. And I thought, what do I do now? So I started hammering at the door. It's God midnight at this point. I'm hammering at the door. No answer. Eventually a window opens and billowing white smoke. They're all on drugs. Billowing white smoke out the window. Somewhat very pale face leans out. And goes, I go, oh, my car, you've got my car. And it took a long time for them to understand what I meant by my car's in your garden. It took a long time. They came down, opened the door. It's freezing cold, by the way. The frost has just descended and my car is completely frozen over. But I want to get out. I just want to get out of this. So I get in the car and it's all frosted over. I shouldn't have been driving because I couldn't see anything. So I've got that little tiny inch window you make for yourself on your windscreen. And I'm hunched over and going very, very slowly. And then suddenly these women start throwing themselves on the bonnet of my car as I'm driving through the red light district very, very slowly. So they obviously think I'm looking for action. And I think, oh, this is a nightmare. But I can't run them over. So I have to keep going slowly. And eventually find a sign that says motorway. And so I'm really, someone might come and arrest me now because I'm admitting stuff, but I deliberately drove all the way home well above the speed limit because I wanted a police car to pull me over because I wanted to shout at them for not helping me out, a pregnant woman out.
Have you been to Ipswich since?
I was sent when they had that murder inquiry.
Oh.
they wanted to know what it was like to be a woman reporter during a murder inquiry.
No.
Yeah, very strange. Oh, and it was deserted then, surprise, surprise.
Right, okay. That does sound pretty nightmarish. Jonathan, can you better it?
Not at all, no. I've had lots of motorway journeys where, you know, especially the M6 and the M1, it's been closed. I used to, my first 2 years of working for the Sunday Times in England, I actually was still living in Glasgow, so routinely would slog up the M74 back up to Glasgow after being at some mad game. But I suppose in terms of being a fan, the last game I went to was actually, the last big Aberdeen game I went to was really properly grim in that it was League Cup Final 2014. I was living in Liverpool at the time. We just had our second daughter, and you know, I was bereft of sleep anyway to start with, but this was Aberdeen's first cup final for some time. I hadn't won anything in 18 years. My cousin was going, who's by the way a mad Barrow fan and knows all the people that were in that feature, and that's just a routine excursion for Barrow. Their traveling's crazy, but I remember going up to this game on a Sunday just shattered, thinking, what am I doing here? Getting to meeting everyone in the pub, couldn't have a drink of course because I had the car. Getting to Celtic Park, you know, Celtic Park wasn't even Hampden, it was Celtic Park, which puts a slight down on things. And just watching the worst game of football I've seen in my life, watching Aberdeen just full of nerves, trying to beat Inverness, Cali, who are our bogey team, who, you know, both teams were horribly defensive, 0-0 after 2 hours, barely a shot on target. Penalties came along and, you know, it was almost as if the penalties weren't even shots on target because there was such a poor penalty shootout as well. And Aberdeen just about prevailed. And I just remember driving home, you know, we'd seen Aberdeen win a cup, just thinking, I feel almost nothing. I just feel numb by tiredness, nerves, sort of the feeling that I should really be at home with the baby and my family. And that sort of, you know, even in victory, just that futility, that feeling that you get as a football fan sometimes, you know, is this really how I should be spending my life?
Jonathan, you've just failed the astronaut interview.
The astronaut? What's that then?
That's just the wrong attitude. You know, you're not someone I'd put on the move.
Well, to be honest, you've all failed the test because Barrow's fans, that was a harder trip home for them than what you all suffered. Yeah. So, but what we should say about Barrow very quickly is first loss for them since the 26th of October. They are still top of the National League, 7 points clear as well. Their next game is a comparatively short 550-mile round trip to Barnet on Saturday in the FA Trophy.
Can I add a little detail about Barrow?
Please Sorry do.
Well, just I learned this from my cousin because he, you know, as I say, travels with those fans. He's a head teacher, so he couldn't go to that particular game, but he knows them all. But he said that what that shows is an incredible relationship at the moment between the manager, Ian Evatt, who people might remember playing for Blackpool, and the supporters. And it started when he arrived, and Barrow's got a supporters trust, which basically has sort of saved the club. And the first thing Evatt did was he appealed to the trust for a little bit of cash because he wanted to buy some GPS equipment to improve training for the players. So they provided the cash for that. And ever since then, there's, you know, him buying them the pies or whatever was, you know, just part of the symbiotic relationship. And then the players going home on the supporters bus, it's testament to what they've built. And, you know, we were talking earlier about relationships between fans and clubs. You know, it's no coincidence having the best season in absolute years, and you know, it's a lovely feature in the Times, and it kind of shows that little special thing that's going on there at the moment.
Yeah, lovely bond that they all have. Okay, it is time for us to finish this pod with a quiz. David De Gea reached a personal milestone on Saturday when he lined up for Manchester United against Wolves. It was his 300th Premier League appearance for United, becoming the 36th player to make 300 appearances in the competition for a single club. Six other goalkeepers have achieved the feat of 300 Premier League games for a single club. So the question is, can you name all six? Now, I'm going to be kind. I won't necessarily ask you to name all six, but maybe we'll go round and we'll eventually get to all six.
Come on,
Petr Cech.
Okay, well, Alison's straight in there with one.
I thought
that
it was
correct.
A team effort,
well,
Alison.
No. She didn't want that, Alison.
What?
The competitive streak
What's
of Alison just came out there.
That's outrageous.
So Alison has gone for Cech, which is correct. Why don't you just all go for it? Go on, then.
David Seaman,
that is another one, Tom. Yeah. Well done. We got that. Okay, that's two, so we've only got
Peter
four
Schmeichel.
More. No, he's not on the list.
He didn't make 300 Premier League.
Tim Howard.
That's right. Yes, see, this is good. Well done, Jonathan.
UC Askalainen.
Well done.
Oh, that's a good one.
That is a good shout.
That makes it 2-1-1, by the way. Just to...
Yes, it does. So, two more.
Brad Friedel.
No, he's not on the list.
Nigel Martin.
No. No,
I'm
Nigel
going
Martin.
Left field here.
Do you need a clue?
No.
No clues.
No.
Right,
no
okay.
clues. David right. James.
Nope.
Joe Hart.
Joe Hart doesn't make the list, I'm afraid. Oh. Got to go. These two are.
We're talking low, a smaller club or big six?
Oh, Hugo Lloris, surely.
No.
Casper Schmeichel?
No Casper Schmeichel either. No, we've got. Well, these two are no longer playing.
Oof. Goodness me. I think I peaked with UC Askalainen, didn't
that was,
I?
That was good.
Yeah.
To be fair.
Alison, you've been very quiet since Petr Cech.
Well, as long as I get one, I don't
well,
care.
Well, you're not allowing me to give you a clue.
Okay, go on then.
I can tell you that both clubs, so there's two keepers and both of them play for two clubs in the northeast.
Oh.
That's just met with silence. That's not good for a podcast.
So Newcastle
goal.
Newcastle goal. Shay Given.
Well, Tom is the winner of this.
So that's 3-1-1. See if I can get
it. Okay, so that's Newcastle ticked off.
Is it Butter?
Mark Schwarzer.
Mark Schwarzer?
Get
in! I wrote down Schwarzer.
Come on! Give me a chance.
Yeah, but we're working as a team, Johnny.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You
okay,
can be on my team.
Well done.
Alison started the competition.
That is it. That's You've fine. Got them all That's right. That. So to go with David De Gea, Jussi Jaskalainen, Shay Given, Tim Howard, Petr Cech, Mark Schwarzer and David Seaman. Just quickly, whilst we're on the subject of goalkeepers then, who would get your vote for the all-time best goalkeeper in the Premier League? Alison? I've thrown that at you.
Petr Cech.
Is that your only goalkeeping answer to everything?
Yeah.
You've like got Petr Cech reflex syndrome.
I feel like it's Toy Story and I have one button.
If in doubt, Petr Cech.
Yeah. That or you're hoping that the answer's always going to be the capital city of Prague and what country? Czech.
No, but if you need me to justify it, his story's amazing, isn't he? The way he came back from cracking his skull and playing with that protective gear. And yes, probably he wasn't quite as brilliant afterwards, but he was still darn good.
Mm. Okay. Tom?
I probably would have gone De Gea until the last kind of 12 months. Mm. And so, I mean, a goalkeeper is such a fascinating position. So I'm going to pick someone who's kind of a bit of a journeyman goalkeeper. I'm going to go for Brad Friedel. Played at lots of different clubs. I think was quite underrated, really. And I think quite often when he played against bigger teams, always put in a hell of a performance. So I'm going to go Brad Friedel.
Brad Friedel for you. Jonathan?
I think I'll go Peter Schmeichel just because Manchester United defined the early success of the Premier League. They built it and he was such a key figure. He was pivotal to a couple of those early titles. Of course, lifted the European Cup. And I think he still defines, you know, set the benchmark for what we think of goalkeepers. But I have to say, the more I watch Alisson, the more I wonder if that's actually the best goalkeeper. He's incredible. I've seen. So I might give you a different answer in a few years' time.
All right, we'll remind you of that then in a few years' time. Jonathan, thank you very much. That is it for now. Thank you also to Alison and to Tom as well. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. We'll be back on Monday, so make sure you have a good weekend.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.